Welcome to the Big Mike Fund Podcast, where you learn about advanced wealth building strategies from real estate investing to creating massive ROI and secured retirement profits. So pour yourself a cup of coffee, grab a notepad, and lean in, because Big Mike has got the mic, starting now.
Welcome to the Big Mike Fund Podcast. I'm the Big Mike, Mike Zlatnik. Today, it is my pleasure and a privilege to have Corey Peterson, the kahuna, the big kahuna, the chief kahuna, joining me on the podcast. Hi, Corey. How are you?
Wonderful, Mike. Wonderful.
Corey is a very successful multifamily investor, educator. He's a brother from the Collective Genius Mastermind. We've been members for many years, known each other. And I wanted to chat with you a little bit about who you are, what you've done, and a little bit about multifamily, how people can be successful in multifamily investing.
Sure, man. Would love to share the story. So yeah, dude, I'm glad to be on here, man. We've known each other for a while. And you know, this thing of real estate investing and doing deals, it just keeps growing. And it's really a fun game to play. And it's always fun to have good friends like you to play it with. So thanks for having me on, brother.
I appreciate that. Thank you for coming. So tell my listeners the story. What's your story? How did you get into multifamily investing? How did you become a successful real estate investor?
So I'll give like the quick version of it. But I grew up a small country boy and on a farm on 180 acres in West Plains, Missouri, which is we call it the Ozarks. And just think of the movie. I'm not gonna say the name of the movie. Just think, feel like a pig, boy. And so the Ozarks was something I really cherished. And but Mike, I barely made it out of high school, and I was not voted most likely to succeed. And I really kind of struggled up until I was 31 with who I wanted to be or what I wanted to be when I grew up. I'd managed restaurants, I'd sold cars. And one day my mom, she was married to a very wealthy man, and she took me to Hawaii. And I went to Hawaii, and I saw this guy. We stayed at this guy's house, and it was right on the beach. Like, it was magical. And the guy had money, he had cars, he had everything that you would think that a successful person would have. And his phone was not ringing. And I remember finally getting enough gumption to ask him what he did. And he told me that he did real estate and that he owned apartments. And that set me in motion. That was about 17 years ago. And it set me in motion to what I do now. And, you know, when I first started, I had no money, no credit. I was just kind of a young, snotty-nosed kid. And even though I was 30, but, you know, I didn't really know how to start. But I started with wholesaling, and I got really good at wholesaling. And this was, you know, when the market was 2008, 9, 10, there was lots of deals out there, finding short sales and REOs. Right. And I got to the point where, man, I'm like, if I could just raise some private money, then, because I was making like $4,000 a deal wholesaling it. And I was managing my investors' rehabs, right? So I was doing all the work for them. And they were making like $30,000 like rips, making lots of money.
Yep.
I was making them lots of money. And what I really needed was some capital. And so I raised my first piece of capital totally by accident. And I played racquetball with a friend of mine. And I was asking him for his help. I wasn't even asking him for money. I didn't think he had any. But he lived in a retirement community. And so I figured he knew some people that would, you know, be able to invest with me. And so I just simply asked him, hey, listen, if, you know, instead of making that small piece, that $4,000 or $5,000, I could probably pay that in interest. So I said I could pay 12% interest and give them a note and deed of trust and ask them if he knew anybody. Well, the next day he calls me. He goes, Corey, do you still want to do that 12%? And in the back of my mind, I was like, man, Carl found somebody. And he goes, Corey, you don't know this, but my home is totally paid off. And I can borrow money at 3%. And if you give me 12, I get to make a spread.
That's right.
How much money do you need? So I gathered all up my strength, right? This was the moment. And I said, Carl, I need $85,000. And Carl was like, yeah, no problem. What do you want me to send it? And like my jaw hit the ground, and you know, I'd never had that happen before where somebody
money.
Yes. To give me money.
That's a great story. So you've gotten from there to here now. So
yeah. So once I figured out how to raise money, Mike, I went ballistic. I always say it was like Clark Kent going into the phone booth, and I came out Superman. Right. Yeah. And I went and learned the rules to how to raise private money. And I really, by doing it by accident, it taught me everything I needed to know, is that you don't ever ask people for money, and that you just share them what you're share the idea of what you're doing, and the right people will always self-select.
That's right.
And so I went and raised millions of dollars, and I started doing lots and lots of fix and flips. And it was at that point in time where I was super successful doing that, but I was a train wreck inside. Because all I was doing was chasing my hiney, running from property to property to property. And it was at my low. I missed my son's game on a Saturday because I was doing stupid real estate stuff. And I felt horrible. And that day, I was coming home, feeling very low. I saw the apartment complex. It's the same apartment complex I see all the time on my way home. And I used to always say, I wish I could own an apartment. But that day I asked myself, how can I own an apartment? And that changed everything for me.
So did you buy that apartment complex that you saw on the way?
No, but I asked myself, I go, what do I know about buying apartments? I go, well, I don't know a whole lot, but where can I get some information? And I went to Barnes & Nobles. I bought four books. The fourth book was written by David Lindahl, and David actually became my mentor. He's out of Boston. I flew and met him and had lunch, and I learned the system, and he taught me step by step by step by step. And so once I felt confident enough, I went out, and it's actually funny how I got my first deal, Mike. I went to a multifamily event. So sometimes you can find deals just by going and being in the right places. And I was at an event where there's probably deals and stuff going on.
Okay.
But this time, normally I go to these things and I'm always trying to find a couple players or, you know, people with money or whatever. This time, because I had I was raising lots of capital, and it was getting harder and harder to find deals in Phoenix, right? This is about 2011. The market was starting to contract. And so I stood up in the back of a room at a multifamily conference and I said, hey, listen, I've got a crap ton of money. And I'm looking for some deals. Is there any deals out there? And man, Mike, I didn't pay for lunch or dinner for the rest of the week.
that's a great story. You didn't have to invest a dollar. You just had to say
this. Everybody was pitching me their deals. Corey, look at my deal. Look at my deal. Can you fund my deal? And it was at that moment that I realized, I call it the Corleone method. Don Corleone.
That's brilliant. That was... very unique way to get attention and to get interest.
I found my first deal. I was able to negotiate from some people that they had $200,000 of their money hard, right? And they were going to lose it if they didn't. They were supposed to close in 30 days, and they didn't have any money raised.
So they locked up. They locked up the deal with a hard deposit and didn't have the capital. Didn't have anything. They just thought they could wing it.
Yes.
Okay.
And so I was able to negotiate a 75% ownership of that deal. And I did this totally wrong the first time, right? I raised $1.4 million in private money, and I did it with unsecured prom notes. Not the right way to do it. It's my first time. I didn't know all the rules. They didn't have a PPM even created. And I didn't know I just called a bunch of my friends and said, hey, send the money over here. And they did. And I sent them a piece of paper. Now, that shows you relationships that you can have. Like when you have really good relationships with people, they will just do it because
they trust you. They know, like, and trust you.
They know I can trust me, man. Now, I took care of him. We actually, a year later, we refied the property, created a private placement, get everybody in the right boat that they're supposed to be in. But so here's what's cool. That was in 2011, Mike. I sold that same deal. I bought it for $3.2 million. I sold it this summer for $8.8 million.
Wow. That is remarkable.
Boom.
That's a boom. That's a home run hit.
We made $4.7 million profit after we, you know, paid everybody from title company. Of which, you know, not all of that's mine. A lot of it's my investors' money, but I think I made out with $2.5 million. Great, great first deal. Plus all the cash flow from, you know, 2011 to 2017.
You know, what's interesting is some people are worried. I don't want to pay too much to investors. And they think that if they pay too much to investors, they're going to work for nothing. The reality is this. If you take better care of your investors than you, what's going to happen? The chances are they will back you on your next deal and your next deal and your next deal. And even if you aren't perfect, they'll come back and they'll be able to tolerate so-so situations. If you overall are successful, they understand not everything goes perfectly. But when you get them a little more than your fair share, per se, it's not a cardinal sin to do well for your investors. In fact, it's actually a good recipe for success.
Man, I can only stress it. If you take care of your investors, that should be your only focus in life, right? I don't even look at the deal per se through my lens. I always look at it through my investors' lens, right? How can I make them money and how can I protect their money, right? In other words, I have to have enough profit of mine to give up to make my investors whole.
That's right.
Right? And if you do that, what happens is your money responds and they just keep giving you more and more of it, right?
That's a track record reputation. You want to show success and then success will attract more capital. So,
and you brought up something when you have a downturn. So I had one deal that I did, Mike. It was my second deal. So that was my first deal. I did so great. My second deal, I bought a smaller property in Tucson, which is close to where I live. And I didn't do so well. Actually, after 2 years, we were just breaking even. And half of it was new capital, and half of it was capital that had been with me on a couple other deals, and a lot of it single family stuff. The ones that had been with me through multiple deals and multiple transactions, they stayed. They invested in my, because we sold that property and got rid of it. I got everybody back their money. I actually had to pay a little bit out of pocket, my own pocket, to make it whole, make it right, and I did. But everybody that was with me through other deals went to my next deal. Now, the new people, they went gone, and they'll probably will never come back. It was their first experience, right? That sucks.
You never get a second chance to make a first impression, but at the same time, those who stick around and they know your character, they'll do well in the long run. So.
Yeah, I got this one guy. He's the largest cattle rancher in Wyoming, right? And really neat guy. His name's Mr. Peters, we'll call him. But he's just a rancher, and he's like, you know, we've done 7 or 8 deals with Corey. He talks in this real deep voice, you know, and you know, we've been. 7 are great and 1 wasn't, but the 1 that wasn't, we reinvested in their deal. And he goes, we're batting 100%.
Yep.
And that's really what happens when you do your capital right. So on that deal, when we sold it, Mike, here's what's really cool is we successfully did a 1031 exchange. And that 1031 exchange, we bought a $12.7 million student housing project. That's got a coverage ratio over 2.
Yeah.
And it's just spitting out money. And that's in Southern Indiana, closer to Indiana University. And great, great deal. And and for my investors too, because they rolled the 1031 with me, right? And so all their money came into as new money, and dude, they're happy as all get out.
Yeah, that's the beauty about real estate. You could do 1031 until forever.
Yeah. So. And it's been a lot of fun. I mean, it's not, you know, it's a process, right? I didn't start off as the multifamily guy. But what I've realized is that a lot of my single family brethren out there, it's hard to make cash flow. Now, I invest for cash flow. I think, you know, you have a cash flowing asset. If the market takes a little dip or whatever, if you got positive cash flow, you can weather that stuff out.
So to invest for cash flow, what's your typical target? So when you market for deals, are you looking for kind of properties with already pretty good occupancy with some value add opportunities so you could improve that operationally? Or are you looking for some really rundown properties where you have to do some heavy lifting? You have to take 30-40% occupancy up to, you know, 85%, or are you looking for 75% occupancy that you could take to 85%? What's your typical target?
Two sweet spots, right? And right now we're only concentrating on pretty much one sweet spot right now. Right now in the marketplace, we are trying to find things that are 85-90% occupied.
Okay.
That already have pretty good operations. And what we're looking for is cracks in the operations. So what I mean by cracks is we'll find some deferred maintenance that's not being taken care of. So there's some rent growth opportunities just for if we make those repairs. We're also looking for bloated expenses, and we see this a lot. We have in our system with my management and everything we have a very tight supply chain in our system. We know how much our labor costs. We're very in tune with labor. And so when we underwrite deals, sometimes we'll see that they've got two extra people on salary that they don't need, that we wouldn't need.
Right.
We can see that as an opportunity right out the go and make that asset perform even better, you know, right out from the gate.
And yeah, that makes sense. Those operational efficiencies could improve the net operating income quite a bit if you have a kind of a old operation with maybe some people overhead, or you could have inefficient operation of whatever, electric.
Yeah. I mean, here's one example of like operations that we really kill it at. These are on B and C properties. We try to buy mainly B properties, but we'll take some C's if they're the right ones.
Yeah.
ACH. So all our tenants, when we take over a property, we start switching all the tenants to what's called an ACH, right? An automatic draft, where we draft their account each and every month for rent. And that doesn't seem like a big deal until you understand how much time it steals from your manager to take, let's say you have 150 doors, right? 150 apartments. And they're coming in 150, you know, every month with checks. Dude, what happens is your manager is just doing like this. All they're doing is keeping their head down doing paperwork.
That's right.
And it takes 15 minutes just to take somebody's check, right? They don't just drop it off because you got to talk to them and how's the dogs, the kids, whatever, right?
Right, right.
And it's a big time stealer on our property. But doing that ACH, and the other thing about that is just the collections. We collect our money really quick, really fast.
On time. They're not late. You run the ACH when it's due, not 2 weeks later. You're not worried about – well, the only thing that can happen if they don't have money in their account, it's going to bounce. But
we re-swipe them. We re-swipe every week real quick, right? We keep trying. But it's a great way for us to do it. Now, here's the other thing that's kind of a silent thing about that is that that will force our tenants – to get bank accounts. And usually if they're coming up for renewal and they don't have a checking account, right, and they've not done it, they're probably not tenants that we're going to keep.
Right.
And because we have to have checking accounts as our part of our process, we get a higher scoring credit tenant profile.
Yeah, that's a brilliant idea. Brilliant operational idea. Real basic stuff. You would think that everybody should have a checking account, but I guess in the C area, they're working paycheck to paycheck. It's a little rough sometimes.
Yeah.
So you're trying to get a better quality tenant for sure.
Yeah.
A couple of very quick questions. So what's the typical size of your deal, what you're looking for today and the type of deals that you're doing? How many doors?
At least 100 doors.
Okay.
We'll take 90-ish, right? And the reason for that 100 is because it supports full management, right?
On-site management.
I'm very unique in what I do, I think, for most operators. I share a 20% of I'm the sponsor in my deals. I usually syndicate and I raise private money. But as the sponsor, I give up 20% of my sponsor to my management company. That is very unique. But I do this, it's taken me a long time to figure it out. But here's what, when I found the right management company, I've been looking, you go through management companies like all the time until I found the right one. And these guys are great. And they're good friends of mine. And so to make sure that we all had the same commonality, the same goal, I made an offer with them. And we talked about it for a long time. But they take 20% of everything I make. Because of that, our interests are so aligned, right? I don't have to look over my back because I live in Phoenix. Most of my properties are across the country.
So this management company is a national company.
Yes.
Yeah, of course, they definitely are aligned and motivated because you give them real equity in the deal. I assume there's a trade-off, and maybe they take smaller management fees or something else. You're not giving it for free, per se.
No. But they still take a management approach to it as well. But for me, I don't have a big office. I run this mainly from my house. I'm at my house right now. And because they will take a lot of the response, and I put a lot of the responsibility on them, and then I manage the manager, right? Very simple for me to do, but that way when we have multiple projects, it doesn't really, my bandwidth is not getting consumed, right?
Oh yeah, you make them a partner. You basically make them a partner, and there's a little bit of a conflict of interest there, both a partner and a manager, but
well, and so we do
it through interest.
By the way, we don't give them a sponsorship ownership in the. We actually we do it through a contract, right? That way we keep it very. We can always fire them, right?
Got it. So you give them an upside. Essentially, if they perform, if they make the property perform better, you're sharing the revenues. It's a rev share. It's not equity share per se.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. I probably should.
So what's a typical exit strategy? What's a typical hold? And what's the example you gave the timing was perfect. So one of the questions that I've faced from investors is people who did not see a downturn, people who have bought essentially from 2009 until now have not seen the ugly. They've only seen the good or the excellent. They haven't seen the bad per se.
Right.
So, now rates obviously going up, the market may turn a little bit. And what are your exit strategies looking 3 to 5 years from now? When the interest rates are likely to go up somewhat, the cap rates are likely to go up somewhat, and the appreciation, the natural appreciation may not be there because their cap rates will compress. So right. It's got to be all forced appreciation, I'm assuming.
It is mainly forced appreciation through rent growth and through squeezing our expense line as best we can. Now, we typically hold for 5 years, and there's a reason for it. Year one, we fix all the broken stuff. Year two, we fix all the broken tenants, right? In other words, we replace them with great tenants. And then the next 3 years is really what we call rent optimization. We're trying to push rent growth the best, as high as we can, possibly can. And what we're trying to create is, because we have complete financials, our back end of our financials, probably the best, it's a Wall Street quality back end, right? Nice, perfect P&Ls, all the reporting. And because of that, what we try to sell to like a smaller family office, we actually go and market to 1030, broken 1031 exchange and a small family office. Our typical purchase size is between $5 million to up to $15 to $20
million. Got it.
Right now we're focusing on actually the bigger deals between $10 and $20 million, but we'll take the $5 to $7 million jobs, right?
Right.
The smaller ones sometimes are not as big enough for a family office, but for the smaller family office it is. It's still a good fit. And what they love to see is a nice, solid, rising income story.
Yeah. And you have a good story to tell. You're a storyteller.
Yeah. Yeah. You got to be a storyteller. And the first thing I tell you is the broker.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You're showing continuously financials and continuously improving operation, and they're buying a mature, fully operating property, and you're maximizing the value of the property through good operations, good process, and then good sales exit.
Yeah, so, I mean, like right now, Mike, we are probably buying stuff 85% occupied. So we love an occupancy play. We like that. Even at 90, we can in our portfolio, we're right at 96% for all our portfolio. So that's pretty good. We believe
that's great. That's better than good. 96% depending where. If you're in New York City, you have almost 100%. I'm here. Vacancy here is pretty low, extremely low. But if you are, it also depends the type of an asset.
So yeah. Even then, so it's funny. This is our philosophy on the management side, is that we believe personally, our management company believes, and they're based, all their employees believe that 100% is achievable, right?
Yeah.
And we push for 100%. We believe that that is the truth. And a lot of times we hit it. Now, we don't always hit it consistently and stay there. But when we hit it at a property level, man, we do a big party for our management team and for everybody. And because we expect it, it happens a lot. And the reason for that is we hold our managers accountable. In other words, when they're in this chair right here, right, and they're at 95%, we say, you need to get out of your chair and go to the businesses that have employees and talk about our apartments and fill your units up.
Yeah, it's a remarkable impact going from 95 to 100 because it's all
profit.
Yeah, it's all profit. There's few vacant apartments. They have no cost. It's just you paid all the bills already at this point. It's all profit. So yeah, I love that philosophy that you strive for perfection and you drive for perfection and you get there.
So. Yeah, more likely you get a lot closer than if you said 95 is good, right? If in our opinion 95 sucks, right? Even though it's good, right? But when you're talking about mindsets of your people, you've got to make them feel like 95% life sucks, and things are wrong, and because we do it that way.
I love it. Corey, I apologize. We're running out of time. This is awesome. I greatly appreciate you coming on the podcast. This is just the wealth of information, and we should do it another one. This is so good. Thank you kindly. Before we wrap up, let me ask you a couple of very quick questions. So question number one, what's your favorite book or any book you recommend to listeners? And question number two, how do people find you? If they wanted to get a hold of you, learn a little bit more about Kahuna Wealth Builders.
Yeah, hold on, man. Watch this. I actually have, if you're going to say what my favorite book is right now, it's this one. This is my book, Why the Rich Get Richer, The Secret to Cash Flowing Apartments.
That's great. Thank you.
So I'll push my book, but honestly, my favorite book is The Richest Man in Babylon, where he says that a tenth of everything I make is mine to keep. For how to get a hold of me, go to kahunawealthbuilders.com. You can hit my podcast URL on that page and subscribe to my podcast. We talk about nothing but apartments and multifamily stuff, so it's kind of fun.
It is a lot of fun. I love your energy and how you're coming across. It's a lot of fun. This whole it's all about a story. Anyway, Corey, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I appreciate that. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you for listening to the Big Mike Fund Podcast. To receive your copy of Mike's How to Choose a Smart Real Estate Fund book, head to BigMikeFund.com or visit Amazon and type Mike's slot name. Keep listening and keep investing Big Mike style. See you on the next episode.